From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as the legislature wraps up and enters into a special session, a big question in Austin is, what will Perry do? Is there another election in the governor's future? And they are tiny, destructive critters, and they are racing across the state. Crazy ants have landed in Texas, and it looks like nothing can stop them. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the past week, one legislative session ended, and before anyone could say, boy, howdy, a special session was called to deal specifically with redistricting in Texas. The only person who knows if more issues will be added to the call is Governor Rick Perry. And that's not the only fun fact that he's keeping to himself right now. People want to know if he's going to run again for governor or for president. Austin political junkies are trying to read the Tea Party leaves and guess what he'll do next. Among them, Harvey Kronberg, editor of thequorumreport.com.
Well, increasingly the conventional wisdom, which is always certain but frequently wrong, is that he will not run for governor, but will go on the speaking circuit, get on some boards and commissions, and do his best to put himself in the pathway of a run for president. Among the thinking is he'll be 63 years old at the end of this term. He's only got a $150,000 pension and a few million dollars in investments, and it's a lot easier to walk out the door at 63 and go become a $1 million a year rainmaker than it is to walk out the door at 67 to become a $1 million a year rainmaker.
If he is thinking about running for president, wouldn't it be better if he ran as a sitting governor than as a former governor? I mean, and is it a slam dunk that he would actually, you know, win the nomination again?
Well, two things kind of play into that. One is that there's no evidence that he's assembling a campaign team. And in fact, Attorney General Greg Abbott, who is supposedly the front runner in an open seat, has very aggressively been putting together a campaign team. When he ran for president, he had a predictable $25 million in seed money available to him just from Texas. I'm not sure that seed money is going to be available to him this time. And in fact, he's being crowded out of the news media almost exclusively by our new Senator Ted Cruz. So the suspicion is that he goes off for a couple of years, becomes the elder statesman of the Texas economic miracle, and continues on consolidating his position with the kind of values voters that he's has in the past been very popular with, and builds a coalition that way. But it is inarguable that as governor, he would, to some degree anyway, have a little bit more institutional support, and that contributors would pony up if for no other reason than that he has veto power.
And he's keeping it mum for now. He had said that he would let his plans be known in June, but is it because if he announces he's not going to seek reelection, does suddenly he have less sway over the legislature?
Not at this stage. He will still have the power to call special sessions. And, of course, we've got a couple of weeks now where he will control the veto pen. If he plays coy, he may go out and have a couple of fundraisers, build up his war chest before making the final announcement. June 17th is when state officials can start raising money again. But there's just based on the flurry of activity around Abbott and the virtual absence of activity around Perry, suggests that the governor may not pursue re-election. All of his most loyal campaign lieutenants have gone on to do other things, and most of them have very little interest in coming back into the campaign world.
People are wondering, you know, they look at what he's doing and if he does something decisive, if how that may factor into the calculus. That he used a veto pen that you mentioned to wipe out a law that was a bill that was passed, a possible law, kept it from becoming law, about dark money in state politics. Now, what was that? why did he veto it, and did it have anything to do with possibly him running for president in the future?
Well, dark money is essentially the result of a supposedly charitable structure permitted by the IRS called a 501c4. They can engage in political conversation, although they're not supposed to endorse candidates specifically. But you can always run a campaign that says, tell Rick Perry not to, or call Senator X's office. They can get their message across if they're opposing or supporting somebody. 501c4s generally do not have to report their donors. They have to report their expenditures, but not their donors. What we tried to do, and what five other states have already done, is if you're going to engage in political conversation, not just cultural and charitable conversation, but political conversation, and you spend more than $25,000 doing that, you need to report your donors. And it was a very, very narrowly tailored law. But we have groups now in Texas called, for instance, Texans for Fiscal Responsibility, created an entity, Empower Texans. It's a very conservative Tea Party group. And up until this last election, they always disclosed their donors. Now, under this guise of the 501c4, they're not disclosing their donors. The problem for us in Texas is that corporate money is still illegal in elections, that foreign money is still illegal in elections, and if people are going to play in elections and we don't know where the money is coming from, there's no way to actually be able to enforce what laws we do have. The governor vetoed it because he said it would have, especially in light of the IRS investigation going on in the background of some Tea Party groups, it would have a chilling effect on conversation, on political conversation and political engagement. That doesn't ring true in the sense that there is no other political conversation that is exempted from financial disclosure.
Some people are saying that it may have been a political misstep to veto this because it does leave open the door for the other other party, you know, the Democrats, who are trying to turn Texas blue, and now they can have unlimited money coming in to support their actions.
Right. There's, but it's even more insidious than that, and may come back to bite the Republicans. For years, trial lawyers have been the poster child for Republicans for evildoers and bad players. And any time trial lawyer money would show up in a Republican campaign, it was a kiss of death for the candidate who received it. Now what essentially they've done is given permission to trial lawyers and other groups to create 501c4s or operate through other 501c4s and parachute into Republican primaries and create at least a financial offset to the most conservative money that's out there. And it could open the doors to a whole different group of center-right Republicans that would otherwise not be able to garner financial support.
Okay, so back tangentially onto the Governor Perry and politics in the next upcoming election. So already Comptroller Susan Combs said she's out. She's not going to seek a re-election again. So we're seeing a scramble now. If Rick Perry doesn't run for re-election, it'll be the first time in 25 years we haven't had the name Rick Perry appear on a ballot in Texas. And so it's a mad scramble. Everyone's trying to move up. And it could be like not very many incumbents, except maybe for Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, because he said he's going to try to – he's running for re-election for that office. But it could be well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about this mad scramble, and what does that mean?
Well, first of all, it's the first time since 1994. If Perry does not run, it's the first time since 1994 that we've had an open seat for governor, which could be competitive. Republicans have been locked in place because the cast of characters for statewide office haven't changed in a decade. Third, Senator Ted Cruz demonstrated that that incumbents are not invulnerable to the right message and to the right timing and a little bit of money. And we've, for over a decade, we've had landlocked candidates who all either want to move up the food chain or move somewhere else in the food chain. So whether or not Perry runs, by Susan Combs withdrawing her name from consideration, it has caused a scramble up and down the ballot for a variety of offices, for virtually every office, actually. Don't forget, we already do have at least one challenger announced for governor, and that's Tom Paulken, former Republican Party chair, former chair of the Texas Workforce Commission, and a big player in education politics. Lieutenant governor's race, we have three announced candidates, and we probably have two unannounced candidates. And it goes down the list. But the what's going to happen is that on June 17th, current office holders can go actually start raising money. And what is going to winnow out the list to a certain degree is in the middle of the summer when we have our next campaign finance reports, there's going to be a beauty contest as to who has raised the most money. And to play in a statewide Republican primary, especially in a down-ballot race like attorney general or comptroller or something like that, probably the threshold to be taken seriously is going to be $2-3 million raised in midsummer. Now, ironically, with all the redistricting stuff that's going off on the side, there is the possibility that we could have yet again another delayed primary, which creates even more volatility and destabilizes the guys like me who are quasi-experienced pundits. Makes it much more difficult to handicap a race if you're going to have a delayed primary.
And it's been people have said that it was the delayed primaries that allowed Ted Cruz to outmaneuver David Dewhurst in the Senate race, in the Senate primary, because it gave him so much time to build grassroots. Let me get back to Susan Combs, the comptroller. Yeah. She said she's not going to seek election again. She's out of politics after being a state rep, then the agricultural commissioner, and now comptroller. Why do you think she left?
I think, well, there is at least an element of truth in the fact that she's getting on in years, and people do want to have a life after politics. But both Todd Staples, the current agriculture commissioner, and Jerry Patterson, the current land commissioner, are openly running for the office that she was most aspirational towards, which was lieutenant governor. And they have both fired truly brutal salvos at her, reminding folks that she was once pro-choice, that she presided over an agency that had over a million Social Security numbers of private individual or state employees on the Internet for a year before it was discovered, and a whole series of, I mean, she's got a long record to run against, and easy to characterize as incompetent. The truth is, I know she didn't want to be comptroller again. She had done that, and it was going to be either up or out. And I think that she saw a truly brutal primary, Republican primary, where typically less than 1.5 million voters determine who's going to be the next statewide office holders, since Democrats are not quite there yet in terms of being able to field winnable candidates.
Tea Party Queen of Texas, Deborah Medina, has announced that she's definitely going to run for comptroller. She had already alluded that she was going to do that, but now it's like, I am in, so in.
It's absolutely certain that she's in. We have a couple of state senators, a couple of state reps that are in, and it's sufficiently down ballot that most voters are not going to pay a lot of attention. Except for the Republican faithful, the activists. Medina certainly got a clear constituency, and in the days of email networks and social media, it would really be, I think, easy to ding Combs in a reelection run, and would have some pretty formidable candidates with conservative records.
But the Deborah Medina candidacy for this seat, that's going to be, there's going to be some electricity there.
Yes, there could be. Now, it's increasingly questionable how strong the Tea Party movement is, and Deborah Medina has some pretty controversial positions that sound good initially, but when you put the calculator to it or the computer to it, may not be viable. But that doesn't necessarily deter Republican primary voters.
Right, the primary voters are that's where a lot of the Tea Party is.
That's correct.
And they decide who gets into the November election, and that's pretty much just, you know, a free ride.
It's definitely the presumption, and it's probably true, is that the Republican primary winners will be the statewide office winners. The world in politics is pretty volatile, and anything can happen. But that is an operative assumption, and until we see some other facts on the ground that are different, that's what we're going to believe. But it's important to note that in the last Republican primary, even with the delayed date, the Tea Party's greatest success was Ted Cruz, but that was because of Washington money, ironically, and that was because he had a weak opponent, and that David Dewhurst had not worked the grassroots for years. He planned to run a 6-week television campaign, and the delayed primary truly disadvantaged him. If you look at House races, which are sometimes a much better barometer of Tea Party strength, you saw the Chamber of Commerce style candidates, people who were mayors and city council members and school board members, actually fared better than Tea Party candidates. And out of the 38 Republican freshmen in the Texas House this last time, only 13 really were lockdown Tea Party candidates.
So if there's no Rick Perry on the ballot, is there no Rick Perry magic on the ballot? Does this mean that the Democrats, if they put together a strong slate of candidates with so many open seats, this might be an opportunity for them?
It could be, conceivably, but there really are only two Democrats right now that are being mentioned that have the star power to be able to do this. And one is Senator Wendy Davis, who outperformed Mitt Romney in a 55% Republican district. She's so popular in her district, and she epitomizes the Obama coalition, which is millennials, women, and minorities. And she would not have to depend on Texas for fundraising. There would be a national infrastructure, fundraising infrastructure available for her. And she's very articulate, has a great life story, but unfortunately has drawn with every redistricting, the senators have to draw to see who gets a 2-year term and a 4-year term. She drew a 2-year term, so it would not be a free ride. She would have to put her Senate seat at risk. And even with everything I just said about her, it would still be a huge uphill battle. And the presumption is that she's not going to make the run. The other would be Julian Castro, the mayor of San Antonio. But he has indicated that he's going to serve out his term. He has a certain amount of star power, and would certainly, I think, galvanize and potentially electrify the Hispanic vote. I think he's indicated he's going to serve his full terms. And in theory, the moment may pass because he will be term limited out before the next gubernatorial election and just be a private citizen, ostensibly. But as Henry Cisneros demonstrated, you can stay in the limelight, be a huge public figure, and keep your political charisma without having to hold the San Antonio mayor's office. So the biggest assumption right now is that 2014 is not the year for the superstars. It's going to be 2018. And if the Democrats battleground Texas, their effort to turn Texas blue begins to win House seats and maybe a Senate seat or two and some consolidate position in the urban counties, 2018 could be strong. And, of course, finally, If Hillary Clinton does run for president in 2016, she has, by current polling, the capacity to actually win Texas, which would be seismic. And in the course of winning Texas, would be building an organization that is could create parity with Republicans.
But Julian Castro doesn't have to give up his mayoral seat to run for governor.
No, but it's very difficult to do both. Run for governor, you've got to be on the road consistently. You'd be accused of being derelict in your duties back home.
But he's got a twin that he could, you know, work that with. So that,
well, there is a, he does have a maybe the best surrogate in the world to go out on the campaign trail for him.
So, well, let me ask you one more thing because we're running out of time here. As the legislative session that just wrapped up, one of the big things that didn't happen that a lot of people wanted to see happen was a Medicaid expansion. Now, this denied about $9 billion for money from coming in from the federal government to provide health care to millions of people in the state who now do not have it. A lot of people who run hospitals and health care businesses were very disappointed. This did not get accomplished in the session. Will this be an issue in the upcoming election?
County officials. If there was a Democratic Party infrastructure, it would be an issue in the upcoming election. But this is the second election after redistricting. If these maps hold, they're still going to be very Republican. But I can tell you that in the 2000s, when Democrats fought Republicans to virtually an even tie in the Texas House of Representatives, the single biggest issue was were education and children's health insurance plan, which is a federally funded program similar to this Medicaid expansion. So I do believe that it will ultimately be a campaign issue. I'm just not sure it will be a campaign issue in 2014.
Harvey Kronberg is the editor of The Quorum Report, an online newsletter dedicated to Texas politics. It's online at quorumreport.com. Away from Austin and closer to the Gulf Coast, that's where you'll find scrambling little crazy ants, but they've been spotted as far into the interior as San Antonio. These little creatures are native to South America and have recently settled in Texas, and they are loving it here. Plenty of food, no predators, and the local species of ants cannot compete. Even the other invader, the fire ant. The crazy ants are spreading across the state like crazy and causing problems. Edward LeBrun is a researcher at the University of Texas and the co-author of a recent study published in the Journal of Biological Invaders on crazy ants.
The name crazy ant is the name for the genus of ants, Nilandaria, and they're referred to as crazy ants because of their pattern of movement. Largely, they tend to run in short bursts and turn, and it gives them a large group of ants, a very erratic motion pattern.
So unlike normal ants that we think of, which follow a narrow pattern, following a little scent trail, they seem very orderly and marching along. These guys are just bug-eyed crazy.
They move a lot more erratically. They do follow odor trails like other ants, so that you will see them moving in kind of a band or a trail along the ground. But when they're sort of foraging individually, they do move much more erratically.
Now, a lot of people, when you first hear about crazy ants, the next thing you hear is that they're wiping out fire ants. So the reaction is, yay, crazy ants. But it's more complicated than that.
They are displacing fire ants in areas where the crazy ants reach very high population densities. They're not necessarily displacing them in all places. Areas with that crazy ants haven't reached sort of extraordinary densities, their fire ants still present, although at much lower abundances. The displacement of fire ants, although it's a good thing from some perspectives, both human and ecological, it has negative consequences as well. So crazy ants don't sting, so that is an improvement, particularly for folks who are allergic to fire ant stings. However, the data that we have to date says that they have larger impacts on arthropods, which are insects and spiders, and they reduce their abundance more than imported fire ants do, and they also reduce the species diversity of these insects and arachnids. They also impact native ant species more strongly than imported fire ants do. So the ecological consequences are greater in some respects. Imported fire ants are also known to have large impacts on ground nesting vertebrates like lizards and snakes and some birds. And we don't yet know whether these tawny crazy ants will have impacts on these groups or not.
Fire ants, they're invasive species that came in the 30s, spread across Texas, and put a lot of stress on the environment. And then to have this other invasive species come through, and it's like a double whammy on the environment, and it could be have a lot of difficulties, a lot of problems, especially if it wipes out many native insects.
Yeah, so yes. So fire ants came through in, as you said, in the 30s, they were introduced into Mobile, Alabama, 30s and 40s, and they spread throughout the southeastern United States and Texas. And the ecosystems of Texas have, and the southeastern United States, have sort of reached an equilibrium with respect to fire ants. And there are a lot of native species that have managed to do just fine in the presence of fire ants. And in recent history, fire ant populations are becoming less dense regionally for a variety of factors. And so it seems like, from an environmental perspective, fire ants are increasingly less of a problem as time goes by. But now we're, at least in some areas, we're going to replace that organism with another that has very different biology and very different impacts on the environment, and the system is going to change as a result.
And there are people who had fire ants, they got replaced by the crazy ants, and they say they would rather have the fire ants.
Yeah, some people certainly feel that way. And that comes more from their, obviously, their impacts on people rather than their impacts on the environment. So crazy ants nest in houses and will come in and come into your house and forage in your house. And so from a annoyance perspective, they're a lot worse than fire ants, which will build mounds in your yard, but as long as you don't step on those mounds, they largely don't interact with you.
So are we just going to wait and see to find these things out, or are we actively investigating?
Actively investigating. Certainly we've documented that they have fairly large impacts on herbivorous insects in general, both herbivores and otherwise predators and decomposers in natural settings. That may be the same as in agricultural settings. As I said, these populations are spreading out of urban areas mostly right now and are just kind of only recently interacting with natural and agricultural settings. So there's definitely work to be done.
Edward LeBrun is a researcher at the University of Texas and a co-author of a recent study published in the Journal of Biological Invaders on crazy ants in Texas. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also post your comments on the website tpr.org and listen to past Texas Matters programs. Texas Matters is also available free on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.